Would you?
So this was the start of the previous lecture. You have to go to slide 33. Yes. There are two or three before that, sorry. 29 maybe. Yes, there. No, one.
The next one.
30, sorry. Okay, so now at the heart, right? So this is another very difficult area that they've given me to talk about, and these type of themes, they need preliminary subjects to be mastered before we can even enter them. I've tried to simplify it in a particular way to make it, you know, a bit attractive for the audience and to relay some of those complex difficulties in an easy way. But still, some parts will be difficult. Now, there were many subtopics given to me. I'm only going to try and approach two questions. So what is the I? And what is the relationship between the soul and body? These two I'm going to try and just discuss a few issues, and then we'll see. I'm not sure until what time we have, because it has been a late start. Okay, so in the first slide. Here, I thought maybe one of Shahid Motahari's books called Philosophical Discourses is a good place to start here, where in this work of his, he, you know, Shahid Motahari, he was a faqih, a theologian, and he's also one of the philosophers. In this book, he compares, he wants to approach the question of the soul. He approaches it from this angle. And he gets this approach from Mullah Sadra, who also uses this approach, but Shaykh Motahari has simplified it somewhat. He compares living or animate beings with inanimate beings. Living beings like plants, animals, humans, he compares them with inanimate beings like stones, for example. And he differentiates the different characteristics and features that each has. And then he says, look, these animate beings share a number of features that are specific to them and which are not shared at all by inanimate beings. And they include protecting themselves. Not only animals and humans can protect themselves, but even plants. They also, when they encounter an impediment of whatever kind, they suddenly change direction of growth, for example. Animate beings have this quality. Also, they acclimatize to the environment. Nutrition, growth, reproduction, all these are specific to animate beings, living beings. Then he says that that which is the cause and source for these differences is a reality. It's a reality, and we're seeing the manifestations of this reality. So it is real. And this reality is non-existent in inanimate beings, because we only saw its manifestation in animate beings, be they plants, humans, or animals. Next slide, please. Then he says this reality and this source of animation of life with its varying manifestations we call the soul or nafs. The Greeks called it psyche. Plants have a soul, animals have a soul, humans have a soul. But so far we're translating the soul, we're referring it to a reality which is the cause and source of animation. The plant's soul manifests certain living characteristics. The animal soul, in addition to those characteristics, exhibits further extra manifestations of life, and the human soul also. So the soul, or nafs, is very broadly defined so far as that thing by means of which a living being exists. Now, as we said before, this can apply in plants, animals, and humans. Next slide. The next question is this source of animation that exists in plants and or animals or in humans, is it material or immaterial? We accept there is a reality, and that reality is the source of many manifestations. But this reality that we're so for, we're calling it the soul, is it a material entity or an immaterial entity? Because as it will become evident during the discussions, there are differences between the soul of plants and the soul of animals. And they're also different with the soul of humans. Where does the difference lie? And we'll speak about that. I just want to raise these issues so you have these in mind as we progress. Now, there are many, yes, I didn't want you to actually put this slide yet because it may divert the attention, yes. There are many proofs that the philosophers bring to prove the existence of a soul, the existence of that source of animation. The first route of action they take is proving it is an immaterial entity, especially with humans and animals. With plant souls, they call their souls material souls. Vegetative souls are material. And what they mean by material isn't necessarily something solid. It means that existence-wise, the soul, the source of animation of plants, depends on plant matter. You get rid of plant matter, that source of animation is eliminated. And since the existence of that source of animation, the existence of the soul in plants depends on matter, existence-wise, they say that vegetative souls are material. In animals and humans, they say their souls are immaterial. Then they come and prove it, because this is important, because this source of animation in me and you, in animals, it's a source of animation, it gives growth, reproduction, nutrition, movement, voluntary movement, sensation. In humans, that source of animation then leads to high order rational faculties. They say this is an immaterial soul in humans and animals, but we're focusing on humans. And they prove it. Monosagro goes through 10 or 11 different proofs, which if I were to go through, I think it will bore you a lot. Alome Tabotaboi has simplified those proofs in his Method of Philosophical Realism. It's a book which isn't read nowadays in the Jose, but it's a very good book, and it's simplified a lot of Monosandro's truths in a very simple form. And he also brings two or three proofs that the soul, the source of animation in humans, is immaterial. What I want to do, inshallah, is do what Alome Tabotaboi did and cover his points, but in a medical setting. After all, my background was in medicine. I can't let it waste away. I've got to use it sometimes. So I'm going to go through a lot of medical scenarios. At least, I think everyone will be very interested in these scenarios because it has a lot of interest attached to it. Okay, next slide. So there's something in philosophy, they call it the personal identity equation. And it reads that person two today is one and the same person as person one at some past time, T1, if and only if P2 and P1 behold the same X properties. So person one, let's say at 5 years of age, is the same person as person two at 50 years of age, if they possess X property. Now this X has to be present in the 5 year old and in the 50 year old. And this debate now, what is this X? What is that unifying factor which makes the 5 year old Farouk, for example me, one and the same as the 40 year old Farouk? Some people say it's a biological organism. And actually, Alon Metabo-Tapoy, one of his proofs to refute this, he says that the whole body, the whole organism, the cells, they regenerate completely every 7 to 10 years. Now, he's using data from medicine in those days. They say roughly the same now also. They say, well, there's nothing that the 5-year-old and the 40-year-old shared if you focus it on its biology, because all their cells are different. Some say it's the brain, we'll go through that. Some say it's one's psychology. And some say it's the soul, but we don't know what the soul is yet. We're still speaking in very general terms. It's a source of animation, okay. But that doesn't help a lot. But this source of animation, is it material or immaterial? But some say this soul is the unifying factor. Okay, the next slide, please. Here, today, medicine can help us to identify what the soul is, but more importantly, its nature. This source of animation, is it material or immaterial? Today, with organ donations, if I were to receive a donation, someone's kidney, let's say, Ahmed's kidney. After the donation, they will still say, that's me. I've received the kidney of someone, but Farouk is Farouk. I can then get my other kidney, something goes wrong, I receive someone else's kidney, I'm still the same person. You apply this donation to all parts of the body, and it reaches a stage where no part of my body is the same as it used to be. So these constant donations I've received. With all these, after each operation, I still say, if they ask me, what's your name? I'm Farouk. What do you do? I'm a seminary student. The I remains the same. The I. However, when it comes to the brain, things differ a bit. The next slide. So here, like this laser thing. What happened in the 50s in Russia? They operated on two dogs in this manner, if you show the next slide too, where they connected the head and four limbs. This is not working properly. But the four limbs of one dog, they connected it to another dog. And the two dogs shared the same blood circulation. The Russians were doing this. And they both were living, although the dog above, which was connected to this whole dog, was showing some violent tendencies towards the dog below. And maybe you can expect that. But here, we don't have one entity. Everyone accepts that here we have two different individuals, two different dogs. The brain, two different brains. Since our two different brains, we have two different eyes, two different individuals. Next slide, please. Then in the 70s, as the space race was happening between Soviet Union and America, at the same time, the brain race was happening. Here, this person here, Robert White, speaking with the previous person, two previous ones, and what he did is an American neurosurgeon. If you show the next slide, please. And this has been documented, and it's in the journal called Surgery. The next slide, please. Here. And we have two monkeys here. The head of monkey A was placed, well, it was first decapitated. Both heads were decapitated. Then monkey A's head was put on monkey B. So monkey B was decapitated. Monkey A's head was placed and connected to monkey B. Now the result was that you have monkey B, but the head is on monkey A. Now this monkey only lived for 8 minutes, but what they did, and this has been documented, they taught monkey A, before decapitating it, a few tests. And in those 8 minutes, they wanted to see if the monkey recalls those tests or not, and it did. And this suggests, doesn't prove definitively, but suggests that this monkey with the body of monkey B, but with the head of monkey A, this new monkey is still monkey A, because the brain of monkey A has been transferred. So the eye goes where the brain goes. I'm not saying the eye is in the brain, no. I'm just saying it follows where the brain goes. So far it seems like that. Okay, next slide. So then the philosophers came into this. These are my old slides, which when I was doing bioethics, this was part of the project on personal identity. I managed to retrieve some of them. So the philosophers then came into the picture. When they saw this is happening, when they saw brain transplantation is a reality now. And it's interesting, many of these dilemmas, I once went and asked many scholars, philosophers in Rome, some of them, you know, teaching Mullah Sadr for 25 years, they kept on telling me it's impossible. And I couldn't think it's happened. This shows the approach in philosophy. That was a red alert for me. That it has to be studied in an applied fashion. If you just stick to a text of a book and just limit yourself, it can be detrimental. Anyway, so he comes with this experiment. It's a thought experiment. All we can say is this thought experiment is not rationally impossible. It hasn't happened, but because of the medical developments, it is possible now for this to happen in the future. It's like going to Jupiter. It hasn't happened, but it's not rationally impossible. After we saw people going to the moon, we said, now we can make thought experiments. What if one day we go to Jupiter or Saturn? So he says, my brain is removed from my body, kept alive, and then hooked up inside a new skull and body. Okay. And that new skull and body is exactly similar to my old skull and body. My old body is destroyed. The resulting person has my brain and a new body. Since my brain directly supports my mental life, the new person is psychologically continuous with me. So if you go to the next slide, here, that's you. Sorry, I think this laser's. Yes. So you're the one on the left, for example. Something happens to the body for whatever reason, you have an accident, then the brain is kept alive, and it's put in a clone, for example, a brainless clone, for example. And it's put in this brain. This new person, if you say, what's your name? They'll say Farouk again. We would expect that with the very little bit of evidence that we have. We would expect that. like with the donations, you donate any part of my body, it's still me. But then if a brain comes, replaces my brain, then the mental life that brain supports is of that individual. Now we'll just stay on this slide for a minute. Then some philosophers came with a new twist to this. You know, the brain has two hemispheres. Connecting the two hemispheres is like a communication channel called the corpus callosum, where data between the hemispheres are transferred. What they found with children who were in accidents and one hemisphere received trauma, before receiving the trauma, the brain transferred the data of that hemisphere through the corpus callosum to the other hemisphere, resulting in this, that one hemisphere does the work. This is it's possible in children though, not in adults, because in children still the brain evolution is still at an early stage. Here suddenly we see that the child with one hemisphere is doing the function of two hemispheres. So then they came up with this thought experiment that, let's say if someone has an accident and they have two hemispheres, if you put one hemisphere in one brainless clone, so I have an accident, you put one hemisphere in one brainless clone, similar to me, but it doesn't have to be similar to me, and the other hemisphere, both of them doing both functions, in another brainless clone, there's no need to say it's rationally impossible, especially with the things that have been witnessed. Here now, you're two people. And if you say, what's your name, to both of them, they will say Farouk. Two people here now. What do you do? I'm a seminary student. And that's possible. There's no problem in that. Now, we have traditions, for example, that Nabi Isa alayhi salam, and some traditions, Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, they were in 40 places at the same time. Now, that I don't know, with 40 people, with two, you can justify it somehow. With 40, we don't need to go through the physical route. There, in the same way that the angels can appear before 1,000 people at the same time, one angel, Archangel Gabriel, فَتَمَثَّلَ لَهَا بَشَرًا سَوِيًّا, and he appeared before Lady Maryam. If we were there, we wouldn't have seen Archangel Gabriel as a well-proportioned human being. Lady Maryam alayhi salam saw Archangel Gabriel as a human being, but that human being wasn't physical. Angels can't be physical. That's another debate. But if we were there, we wouldn't have seen the angel. In the same way that when I'm dreaming, that which I am seeing, the person who's sleeping next to me can't see, because that dream is continuous and in unity with my soul. The dream is a product of my soul. Here, Archangel Gabriel can appear before many people at the same time. Nakir and Munkar, if a million people die at the same time, they will all see the questioning angels, because that's a product of their soul. With immaterial entities, there's no limit to number. So that's why the scholars, what I thought, especially say Amir al-Mu'mineen, the 40 people, they saw Amir al-Mu'mineen. They were awake and they saw Amir al-Mu'mineen, but it was a vision of Amir al-Mu'mineen. It wasn't a physical Amir al-Mu'mineen. Because if you have 40 physical entities, you call them all Amir al-Mu'mineen, they will have a brain, a soul separate to the other. That's going to be problematic. One isn't the other anymore. It can't be. Unless you find a route. I mean, with two, you can do something. With 40, it's not impossible. But there in that story, where he was at the same place in 40 times, those 40 people they saw, they had visions of Amir al-Mu'mineen. So they came and said, we saw him at night. He said, I saw him. He said, I saw him. In the same way that 40 people who are dreaming They can dream of Amir al-Mu'mineen. The same can apply once you're awake. And they see Amir al-Mu'mineen not with the physical eye, with the same eye that they see in their dreams. And nadaro ila wajhi Ali ibadatun. Seeing the face of Ali alayhi salam is ibadah. But even the munafiqeen would see the face of Ali. It's not the physical face which is of value. If you manage with your spirituality to transcend the physical realm and manage to see the barzakhi reality of Amir al-Mu'mineen, that's of value. It happens in dreams, it can happen whilst awake too. Okay, the next slide please. Now we want to understand in these medical scenarios, for those who find it, you shouldn't find it offensive. These are just medical things I want to show. It's actually one experience I once had in one of the places in Tabligh. On day one, there were a few brothers, and I was sitting in the room with a few brothers, and there was a Khoja and an Iranian. And the Khoja was from Tanzania, and the Iranian from Iran. And they both said the same thing in front of everyone. The Khoja, they both were in this country for more than 20 years. The Khoja said, "I'm American. It's impossible for me to go back to Tanzania. I can't live in Tanzania anymore. I'm pure American." I said, "Okay, no problem." Yes. Then the Iranian said the same thing. "It's impossible for me to go back to Iran. I've been here for 30 years now. Don't even mention it. I'm a pure American now." And I said nothing. It was so big. Nothing wrong with being an American. Then that place, they wanted me to speak about family issues. He said, "Look, brother, you have to speak about the ills that the youth are facing." And I said, "Okay, no problem." So I started speaking about the ills, some of the problems that the youth are mentioning, and I mentioned masturbation and other ills. After that talk, the Iranian came to me and said, "Brother, astaghfirullah, why did you speak about this? My daughters, my sons were there. You're a man of the cloth, you're speaking about this, astaghfirullah, come on." And I said nothing. Usually, I'm very peaceful with in these scenarios. I let them say whatever they want. But the Khoja, he said nothing. He said, "Well done, brother." It was important. So this showed that the Khoja was the true American. But this was normal. In America, this is normal things when you speak about it. But the Iranian was still Iranian. He was under the pretense that he was an American. So don't be offensive. These are... So in this first example, now, there are three terms I have to explain though. Sex, gender, and genetics. The sex of a person is a function of one's physical genitalia, one's anatomy. If the anatomy is such, you're female. If your anatomy is such, you're male. So, sex is a function of one's anatomy, male and female. Gender is a function of one's psychology, how one thinks. It may be masculine, it may be feminine. Genetics depends on the chromosomes. If you're XY, you're male. If you're XX, you're female. The urologist pertains to the physical criterion of sex. The psychologist or psychiatrist looks at the gender as the criterion, and the geneticist looks at the chromosomes. Try to maintain these three as we go through. We want to see what happens to the eye here, the soul. Here, the brother here on the left, let's call him Peter, well, this is a real story, I just can't recall his real name. And he was XY, so it was male, of male sex. Genetics, XY, the genitalia was of a male, but the gender was female. was very, very feminine in gender. And what happened was, he had these operations done on his body, and after the operations and the hormone therapy that he had, the genitalia becomes that of female now. The gender remains female. It was female on the left, remains female on the right. It's the same person. The sex though changed. On the left he was male, now he's female, sex-wise, not gender-wise. He was female gender-wise then, and he remains female gender-wise after the operation. Genetics though, in both cases, is male. He was XY in the left, XY still on the right. So if you say, what's your name? The lady will still say Peter. The brain is still the same brain. The eye is the same eye. But for simplicity's sake, he may change the name from Peter to Jane. So that, you know, it's on the par with how it looks. So here we see that sex is not essential to the eye. We want to see whether this eye is immaterial or not. If we prove that the eye is not material by default, we've shown that it's immaterial. Here, we see that sex is secondary to the eye. It's not essential to the eye. In the next slide, please. Now imagine this scenario, that Peter doesn't have that operation on the body, but rather Peter's brain goes into this brainless clone, which is the third on the right, which is a female body, but the brain is the brain of Peter. Now look at the sex, gender, and genetics. So Peter was of male sex after this operation, where the brain goes in a brainless clone. This woman, for example, is the brain of Peter, though. The sex becomes female. The gender remains the same. It's still female. He was of female gender before. And the genetics changes. Peter now is XX after this operation. This operation doesn't happen now. They haven't perfected the technology. But it's possible. It's not rationally impossible. And so here we see that genetics is not essential to the eye, because the eye persists even though the sex and the genetics have altered. The next slide, please. So here, now imagine that strong-looking fellow on the left has a masculine gender, masculine sex, male sex, male genetics, but he suffers from a psychiatric problem, which we have this in psychiatry, and I think there are one or two psychiatrists here amongst the audience, where they have a disgust and hate towards their physical body. They keep on amputating themselves, burning themselves. Imagine that a man now wants to go into a female body. For whatever reason, it's possible. But the psychology was male, the gender was male, the sex was male, the genetics was male. If you take the brain of the person on the left and put it in a brainless clone, this woman, the result is the sex and genetics are female, but the gender is still male. Now, if that may or not change over time, depending on these hormonal secretions, after all, the pituitary gland is in the brain. Depending on the secretions there, it may evolve into a female gender too. But there again, it's showing that genetics and sex, it's not essential to the eye. Next slide, please. Now imagine this scenario, that we have someone, male sex, gender, and genetics. What they do is they hypnotize the man. Going back to psychiatry again, we see this on the walls. I've seen it two or three times. When the woman, what I've seen was a woman, she said, I'm Lady Diana. And she would do everything, and she had all the details too. She was engrossed in this idea that she was Lady Diana. And she expected people to, you know, sort of be courteous on greeting towards her. Which is okay, those kind of patients, you kind of give in. But here, let's say if you hypnotize a man with male sex, gender, male genetics, you hypnotize them, only hypnotize them, so they think they're Lady Diana in all dimensions. The sex remains male, it still looks like that. The genetics, it's male. The gender, though, is what? It's female now, after hypnosis. Because they're thinking like Lady Diana. But it's the same eye. No one says that is Lady Diana. That man has been abused. Okay. But there's no change in eye. The eye is still there. Showing that gender, even, is secondary to the eye. It's not essential to the eye. So what is this eye then? Okay, next slide, please. This was a film a long time ago. I saw it when I was, you know, in my early teens, I think. Harrison Ford played in it. A man, 40-year-old businessman, goes into a shop. A thief comes, shoots him in the head. He loses all memory and now has the level of consciousness of a 2-year-old. And then you have to teach him everything now. Writing, it's based on a true story. Writing, everything. This is your wife, this is your house, everything. And then he grew with a very different personality than the previous one. And it so happened that the wife preferred the second personality. But it's the same eye. The eye hasn't gone anywhere. The eye has been crippled, action-wise. But no one says this is another person. Next slide, please. This was another film, which I did actually see this film on Emirates, Jumper, where someone would teletransport from one place to another place. That seemed to be the idea of the film. It's possible for someone to move very fast from A to B, covering a far distance, in the shortest of time. But teletransportation, with this meaning, that the body vanishes, disintegrates, and then the same person appears in another place of the world instantaneously, that's problematic. That there's a problem there. The problem isn't that you can't, and a human being can't appear instantaneously from matter. No, it's possible. But what is that person the same I as before? That's the difficulty. Why is it difficult? Because let's say when the body disintegrates in A, the soul still persists. Now you want to create the same body from matter instantaneously through teletransportation, although teleportation only applies maybe to subatomic particles today. Whether it will one day be realized in human beings, that's another issue. But the point is this, that if the person in place A, the body is disintegrated, the soul persists though, because the soul doesn't depend on the body existence-wise. So if the body dies, our soul, for example, when we go to Barzakh, now you want to create out of, let's say, earth, you can't create out of nothingness, because nothingness doesn't exist. You want to create from earth a human being, instantaneously. It's possible. It's not impossible, and Allah has done that. But then, from earth, in that evolution, when you want to create that human being, during the process, ensoulment arises, 4 months into gestation. Now, the soul already persists. So what is this soul at 4 months? Now we have two souls. And so this song can't be the previous one. And that's the difficulty, on a par with Sadra philosophy. The other philosophers who have other interpretations, they have a very difficult time explaining this. If you don't be careful, you fall into the trap of reincarnation. But more of this will be said maybe later. The next slide, please. So here's summary so far is that sex, gender, psychology, these are accidental. Or they're secondary to the eye. Altering one's gender is a surety in the future. One's eye need not be on a par with one's psychology. The eye follows the brain, but that doesn't mean it's equal to the material brain. Brain transfer, yes, the other one's a bit too medical, we'll get into that. So, now, so far we've established that the eye follows where the brain goes. But you can always think of instances where one day in the future, maybe we'll have these chips which replace a part of your brain, but maintain that brain function. So you have a living brain, and then with a series of operations, gradually, chip after chip, you now have a material brain. And maybe that brain function can be maintained. You can't start with something material. And the whole discussion of artificial intelligence, these robots, when you start with something material, they mimic and simulate emotions, but they're not aware that they have these emotions. That self-awareness is never there. That awareness of the I is never there. There's no I even there. That's different. But it's possible that, I'm trying to suggest that the brain itself isn't the criterion, the physical brain. Brain function is important. And brain function is immaterial. When you dream, it's a function of the brain. Are your dreams physical in any way? It's all immaterial, there's nothing physical about it. Okay, so here with these experiments, and there are many other types of experiments, for example, the concept of dreaming they've discussed that in great depth. It's another way of proving that the soul has to be immaterial and not material. And there are other ways too. So here we've tried to establish that this soul, the I, is immaterial. If we believe that the I is immaterial, we come up with a problem. Now, the next slide, and this is the final slide. I didn't really have time to complete these slides. It's a question of interaction. Interaction between the soul, this immaterial entity, with the body. How are we going to explain that? Because for sure, there is interaction, both ways, between the soul and body. Things you eat can cause emotions within you. Those emotions are immaterial. But sometimes your depressive state can lead to bodily effects, the realm of psychosomatic effects, for example. There's definitely a relationship here. But this philosophy is very difficult for them to pinpoint the nature of this interaction. Because immaterial beings, they can lead to, and they can be a cause of things coming into existence. Okay. There's no problem there. Something immaterial being a cause of a plant growing into a tree. Or anything else. But that's in relation to ijad, bringing it forth into existence. But when it comes to interaction, the two things which are wanting to interact, they have to share a common denomination. If one is totally immaterial and the other is physical, how are they going to interact? Because the immaterial has no place. Doesn't have a place or a time, or it's not like the body. So how does this interaction occur? And here we see that the philosophers, they have difficulties in proving it. Plato believed that the soul existed before the physical body. Although these things are attributed to Plato, or attributed to Aristotle. These people were men of God. According to Ayatollah Hassan Zadeh, he uses traditions to show that Aristotle was a prophet. Socrates, the Hippocratic Oath, Hippocrates, he was also a prophet. There were many of them. Pythagoras was a prophet, according to Ayatollah Hassan Zadeh only. You know, with the equation of the triangle, the hypotenuse of it. He brought the whole idea of numbers. Although some people believe that Idris was Pythagoras, it's just the names, but that's a whole different argument. So Plato believed that there was an immaterial spirit or soul. Soul, nafs, and ruh, it's one reality, it's the same. But when this one reality is in affinity with the physical body, they call it a nafs. When it's detached from the physical realm, that same reality they call a ruh. They're not two beings. Just depend on its spiritual status quo. He believed that the spirit existed before. So we use the word ruh here, because ruh we used in relation to the eye when it's detached from the physical realm. Plato says, it's attributed to Plato, that the spirit existed before the physical body. And then the spirit descended. Now what does it mean for something which has no time or place to descend? He says it descended, and then it became attached to a physical body, and they worked side by side, like a person on a chair. And this spirit is controlling the body, but it's two independent substances. The spirit is one independent substance, the body is another independent substance. It descends, becomes attached to it. It's not in it or anything. They're in juxtaposition with one another. And perfection, according to Plato, was to become independent from this physical body. But he never, according to the scholars, he never managed to explain, so how do these two interact? How can something immaterial interact with something material? He couldn't. Aristotle came and said, look, there was no spirit before the physical body. Again, this is attributed to Aristotle. He says there was no spirit before the physical body. The spirit appeared at the same time as the body, as this third entity, so to speak, where the idea of form and matter, the form of something, for example, an apple has matter. That which makes it an apple is its form, its specific form, its suratun nawiyya, as they say in philosophy. The specific form is that form which the matter evolves into. And that's why an apple is different to a cup, is different to a human. It's that form which makes it different. The soul is the form, whilst the body is the matter. And these are a hybrid, a compound, it's one entity. With Plato, he said, they are two independent substances. Plato, therefore, was a dualist. Aristotle, on the outside, looks like a monist. There's one entity. The problem they attribute to Aristotelians is, he said that it can never be without a body. The form can never be without a body, it needs matter. So then what happens after death, and there's no matter anymore, it disintegrates. And the Aristotelians had difficulties showing it. Then they speak of another kind of body coming, and that has its own problems. Then came Ibn Sina. Now, to explain Ibn Sina, I have to explain the concept that philosophers of old had, that the principle read as follows, that تداخل الوجودات هل هي ممكن أم لا؟ This same occupation between two beings occupying the same space, is it possible or not? And beginning this is not possible. For example, if you have light everywhere, and there's a crystal ball in the room and light is everywhere. All the photons of light and that crystal, the atoms of the crystal, are they occupying the same space? Or is the photons of light in the lacunae or this empty areas within, between the atoms of that crystal? Now here, the physicists can tell us what is and what isn't. They can't say if it's impossible or not, but that's the work of the philosophers. Here some physicists say, no, the photons and those atoms of the crystal, they're occupying the same space. It's not as if they're not occupying, the photons are only the free areas between the atoms. Although the philosophy of matter is something which I think is important for you to read upon. A lot of dilemmas are sorted out if you read the philosophy of matter, but that's another debate. So then the philosophers came and said, look, this preoccupation, the same occupation of two beings, actually it's a vajib, it's obligatory. And they do that because of their understanding of Tawheed, where Allah is everywhere, and now Allah is creating. There's a tradition from Amir al-Mu'mineen in relation to Allah. It says, Huwa Allah dakhilun fil ashya, is in all things, al-ashya, all things. La bin mumazajah, but it's not as if it's blended in them. Allah isn't matter. وَهُوَ خَارِجٌ عَنْهَا, and he is outside all things. لَا بِمُزَايَلَةٍ, but it's not mutually exclusive from them. So there, they say, so by necessity, it's wajib that things occupy the same space. And they use this Tawheed example. The reason I gave that was because Ibn Sina, in relation to the soul and body, he uses this concept of tadakhul, same occupation of space, where he also believes that there was a spirit before the physical body. It comes and shares the same space as a body that can act as a recipient now. They share the same space. The soul is much bigger than the body though. The body is part of the soul. They share the same space though, like a writer and a pen. The pen is just used, the body, the pen is just used as a means for the eye to act. But the eye isn't the pen. So he uses the concept of tadakhul in relation to the soul and body, but the question still remained unanswered, even with Ibn Sina. He approached it once in his letters. It was referred to, but it wasn't. No one accepted it. Because at the end of the day, you believe that the soul is immaterial, which Ibn Sina believed in. You can't justify that interaction with a physical entity. Because these two are mutually exclusive. Then we come to Mullah Sadra. He comes with this principle. 400 years ago, of substantial motion. This is like the second law of thermodynamics of Newton, for example, or Einstein's relativity. These are very important principles. 400 years ago, Mullah Sadra also brings a principle that's never really been paid attention to, though, like Einstein's principle has and Newton's. But it's certainly worthy of attention. And since time is ending, I want to finish this, though, because it'll be a pity, you know, not to, you know, give you some kind of answer to all this talk and everything. Yes. Yes. No, yes. So here, he says he believes in the evolution of matter. The zygote is something material. And the vegetative animation that it has, it means there is a soul in a zygote. But the soul is materialistic. That source of animation depends on that matter, existence-wise. This substance of the zygote evolves, for example, in the womb. The substance itself, that soul, evolves bit after bit. The existence of the soul, albeit vegetative, and therefore being dependent on matter, its affinity is essentially materialistic. The soul can't do without the matter. The soul, it's vegetative though, it evolves. And this vegetative soul keeps on evolving until it acquires a semi-immaterial dimension, a Methali dimension. And that happens at 4 months. At 4 months, the I, the human soul, which did not exist before 4 months, the I now starts, and perceptions also start at 4 months, albeit rudimentary. But it was this evolution of something material, bit after bit, the substance of the soul evolving bit after bit, and this material entity becomes material, semi-immaterial, because those perceptions are now semi-immaterial. There's nothing physical about them. Our perceptions, like our dreams, there's nothing physical there. So when we come to the human being right now, the human being is an extended creature with a number of dimensions. It has an earthly physical dimension, and it has more immaterial dimensions. But when it has those immaterial dimensions, it doesn't lose the physical dimension. It's an extended creature. We have this physical body right now. We have a barzakhi body right now. And like that, he says, yeah, it's one entity, the human being. But this one entity is multidimensional, and those dimensions all interact with one another.